Welcome to the Legacy Podcast Series from Chapter 4 Uganda. Visit us at chapter4uganda.org to subscribe, receive a newsletter and updates on our work and that of our partners on civil liberties in Uganda. Television show says I needs no introduction, but I'll allow him to introduce himself. Welcome to this Legacy Podcast Series by Chapter 4. That focuses on human rights and human rights-related issues in Uganda in 2024. In this particular podcast, we shall have an eye to the next 12 months because of the nature of what my guest does. But, George, please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Angelo. Pleasure to be here. My name is George Musisi. I'm a legal practitioner with a particular emphasis on human rights and constitutional legal practice. I'm also a social commentator on legal political issues.
That is to put it mildly. But you're also famous because one of your clients is the face of the political movement associated with Uganda's demography. For people who are listening to us, Uganda has one of the youngest populations in the world, and that population has been considered the restless generation. Tell us about this famous client of yours.
I think you're talking about Bobi Wine, Robert Kyagulanyi Ssentamu, the president of the National Unity Platform. And of course, he represents a party which I think members or supporters of it have faced the biggest brunt of the violations in the last, I think, 3 to 4 years. I can imagine, because at least I've been party to a number of cases. People are talking about now of court martial trials. We're talking about 9 people still in custody. At some point, there are over 400 people.
If we could park that for a second, let's just characterize what's at issue here. Before he got into politics, Robert Kyagulanyi, who is also Bobi Wine, was in fact just a musician, he's an entertainer. Then his audience was also young, mostly in the ghettos. Why is this category of people defined by their age, maybe where they live? Why have these people become a political problem? Then we can talk about how that has translated into the human rights issues that your profession has had to respond to.
The why, I think, is one, there's a general trend everywhere in the world that the youths are usually very politically active. They're usually very engaged and they're usually in urban areas. In a particular case, because all revolutions everywhere, the youths have been at the forefront, even if you look at the long struggle with apartheid. Even people who spent so many years in custody, they started largely youthful. And then when it comes to the particular case of Uganda, you've mentioned that, yes, we have a very youthful population. But then there's also the issue of social media, that it has become so easy for youths to either communicate or receive the news. Of course, social media comes with its problems and its advantages. But the biggest one is that news spreads so quite fast. That means that a leader can easily remember, Angelo, there was a time when political leaders addressed their people through press conferences, the weekly press conferences, which were later reported on the national news and then the newspapers. So now a message will reverberate from someone's sitting room across the biggest section. So the youths use these apps a lot. They are on all sorts of social media apps. Secondly, still this is a particular case of Uganda, is that there seems to be a strong disconnect between the youths and what they call the haves. Because we have a population of youths who are educated, but either underemployed or not employed at all, many of them. We have those, a big section, who are trying to eke out a living amidst all sorts. He has a Rolex stall, he has a small saloon, cafe. Of course, cafes are now much less. But they're trying to eke out a living. He has a riding a border border, amidst all sorts of challenges. Then the other group of youths, they dropped out of school and they're not doing anything. They're not doing anything. And those are so many. The petty crime in Kampala, people who snack off, who pluck off people's side mirrors in broad daylight. Some of them are 17, or at least they look. People who hit pedestrians. There was a lawyer who was killed about 3 years ago. She was hit with a paver because they were trying to grab her laptop, and they grabbed it somewhere in Chiwatule. When police arrested the suspect was 19. So we have that group of people. They have nothing to eat, basically, and they're just surviving, to use the typical Ugandan slang. So all that make a very huge cocktail of disgruntled people. And then on the other hand, you read scandal after scandal newspapers. You read scandal after scandal that there seems to be, whilst people are grappling with what to eat, they're in the same country, there seems to be ministers grabbing whatever they can, whatever is reported. You see statutory bodies buying guzzlers, 500 million vehicles, even with escort. So there seems to be a strong disconnect. People feel that they're not part of the same country.
Besides, it's all visual, right? Because they have the phones. Mm. They can communicate with each other. Reality is reflected back harshly sometimes. And yes, you know, there's scandal after scandal for those who are trying to understand what's going on. But Kampala also appears, it's a city that's defined by inequality, but it also appears like a wealthy city. There are new buildings going up, expensive cars and expensive restaurants.
Actually, Angelo, that is one of the biggest delusions about this country. Yes, there's also a group of youths who throng these bars and so on and so forth. Because in Kampala, you also find a bar which sells a bottle of water at 10,000, and you find it packed and so on and so forth. But the real estate industry, the luxury lifestyle industry in Uganda can be quite misleading. Someone was making a point, and I agreed entirely with that person, that if corruption is fought vigorously and reduced drastically by over 80%, the land prices in Uganda would go down drastically by the same measure. So you would find, and I don't want to be a speculator like many Ugandans are, that building is owned by Angelo, that one is owned by... But indeed, there's a lot of truth that you find one person, either in government or outside it, but a rich person owning 10 buildings, irrespective of how they got that money. If you go to some of these neighborhoods which have just come up in the last 10 years, Najera, Chira, Chiwatule, you find, leave alone the homes, but you find the commercial buildings that there are about 10 landlords owning the commercial buildings, that many of them that you see.
Okay, we're getting to a point where we can all agree that there is inequality. Then there's also a demographic lack of parity between those who are running the country, like the president and his class, and a very young population, and then you throw technology in the middle of it. So your client is a political activist, lyricist, musician, and now leader of a major political party. It appears to me like there are multiple human rights related issues that this situation raises. For example, on the technology side, you have privacy and surveillance. Then there are issues of access to within the ghetto, for example. You've got things, basic things like access to food, access to water, habitation, sanitation. How do you balance which of those rights to focus on? Or are you just by the nature of, say, the persecution that someone like Bobi Wine, in the way of seeing him arrested and in some cases brutalized, that becomes the focus of your service?
Actually, we've not had the privilege of choosing the focus, because many times we've been on the defensive. We've been replying or responding to what has been thrown at him and the group that he leads. So by the nature of, we've not even had a chance to challenge some of the substantive issues that maybe we could challenge, because it's always been more firefighting, because you're responding to a violation that has occurred. Angelo, if you could indulge me, there was immediate after elections. You remember what happens every time the leading opposition has happened to Dr. Besigye many times. After voting, his home is surrounded, such that he doesn't go out. So I remember even in 2021, it was the same thing. And as I was driving there together with my colleague and later on, together with my colleague Benjamin and the LOP, now Joel, we were stopped at the gate. When we were told, can we talk to the commanders? And of course, the commander said, not even lawyers can access. So we made an impromptu meeting there and then, and later on, we joined us, and then we decided to file the matter in court. And of course, eventually, the army was, High Court ordered the army off the premise. So I'm just trying to show you that has always been a firefighting mode, that you don't even have a chance to sit and reflect that, okay, what should we sit and challenge, because it's always been one thing after another.
You're fixing the plane as you fly.
Exactly.
So, but there must have been periods of reflection. I'm saying this because Bobi Wine, National Unity Plan, all the other political parties in the opposition, nonetheless have a platform of their own. So amidst all of this that's going on in the human rights area, what is the analysis of the issues the public should pay attention to from their experience?
It all comes down to the broader issue, and that is what has preoccupied us, including any analysis, the broader issue of the respect for the rule of law, because it all comes down to that whatever right you're talking about, if it cannot thrive, it cannot be enjoyed in a sea of impunity. So, of course, many things have been, as Noop, as Bobi Wine, and many of the people around him, it's largely been civil and political rights which have been violated. But then, beyond the civil and political rights, the biggest question I think that we are facing as a country is the issue of the rule of law. Because rule of law is basically saying, let the law be applied to all without...
Impartially.
So that, I think, has been the biggest concern. That has been the biggest issue. And it's still the biggest issue, that there seems to be one set of laws for a particular group of people. Angela, I can refer you to something which is as recent as a couple of days ago. You saw the policemen who were sent... yesterday, I think they were... Police council decided to dismiss them from the force because of a viral video of dragging an old woman in Barara.
This is there's a video of a woman arrested brutally by four police officers in a land dispute that went viral.
Yes. And then when it went viral, you see how fast police has responded. They spent a court the following day and it recommended action, and indeed they were dismissed. Now, just juxtapose that with the number of brutalizations that have happened to political activists, sometimes even in broad daylight, that nothing has been, no action has been taken. It seems to send a tacit message to the police officers that, no, if you're dealing with political activists, you can do this and go with it. This was a non-political issue, a land dispute to a woman. However old that woman would have been if she was wearing a red beret or she was in an FDC rally being stopped by police. So that's what happens. And I think that has been the biggest concern for Bobi Wine, for the group that he leads, that how do we go out of here? And we seem to be digging ourselves deeper each and every other day.
So what is the direction of travel for next year, which is a campaign year, it's an election year? I'm sure political activity is going to be heightened, not reduced. What is your sense of what the human rights landscape is going to be like going into 2025? We had an election a while back. I think compared to the previous election, it was very violent. It appears like from one election to the next, the rate of violence continues to increase. So what are your expectations? And, from a human rights perspective, what are those things that we should look for?
I don't want to be a prophet of doom, and I'm hoping and praying that my prediction doesn't come to pass. I'm hoping, but I also want to be a realist because of what we witnessed in the last election, because of what we've witnessed with the NRM government. I strongly believe that everywhere that the government has faced strong opposition, it has resorted to human rights violations.
Strong political opposition.
Strong political opposition. It has resorted to violations. You can retract to Teso, to Northern Uganda, to Rwenzori. There are always all sorts of... Now, it had never been that strongly rejected in central Uganda. That's why, Angelo, most of the violations, if you talk about the missing persons, they're all from central Uganda. If you talk about 98% of the people have been... civilians have been remanded in court martials, all from central Uganda. It's because of that reason. So I don't want, seeing that there's not been a fundamental change, one in the popularity of the government, but then two in it responding to the needs of that, what you call the restless group initially. I don't think that there may be a difference from what we saw. Because what we saw, Angelo, in terms of violations, we saw extrajudicial killings on the streets of Kampala. We have a government report which said 53 people died by bullets. That is November 2020.
Gunshot wounds.
Yeah, by gunshot wounds. And 43 of them were by stray bullets. This is, I'm quoting even the government report. We have people who are missing loved ones. 18 people missing. I've represented them in the High Court and now in the Court of Appeal. As a result of that election, we saw arbitrary arrests, what we call the drone arrests, being becoming commonplace. I've been into the High Court over 50 times seeking orders of habeas corpus for people who have been arrested incommunicado without, and then they later turn out to be in the hands of the state. So all of them political associated. So having seen that, we saw, of course, the issue of trials of... because I don't think the court-martial have been used to try civilians on such a huge scale, especially politically affiliated civilians, like they did since 2020. So I don't want to paint a very... I have a pessimistic picture, Angelo, but I'm also a strong believer in better, and I'm hoping that my prediction doesn't come to pass. So in terms of human rights violations by the state... I think it will take a strong pushback by the general public, irrespective of political divide, to hold people to account.
Let's do two things for our international listeners. First, explain to someone who is non-Ugandan how civilians come to be tried in large numbers in a military court, which is set up essentially to try military officers for violations.
Of course, we have a law which sets up, we have an act of parliament which sets up those courts. And it says that if a civilian, there's a provision in that law that if a civilian is either caught with stores or attire or apparatus which are ordinarily preserved of the army, or if a civilian is an accomplice to a crime together with a serving officer, then they can be charged in the military court. However, we've also received pronouncements from the Constitutional Court. The Constitutional Court is the court mandated to interpret the Constitution. And we have two pronouncements which state that the trial of civilians in court martials is wrong. One of the decisions was appealed, and the Supreme Court appealed by the Attorney General, and the Supreme Court granted a stay, meaning that the trials could continue as they await the decision of the Supreme Court. However, the other decision, which was even later, has never been appealed, has never been stayed. And in fact, even the reasoning, because of that decision, which has never been appealed, was different. In that decision, the court said that among the functions of the UPDF, administration of justice is not one of them. Administration of justice is purely for the judiciary. So the court said that it was wrong for parliament to even enact a law which gave UPDF powers beyond what the Constitution gave them. So, however, we saw the army, first of all, politicizing not just the beret that are known for, the UPDF are known for, the National Unity Platform, the leading opposition party was known for, but even criminalizing the color. Many people are arrested for having a red T-shirt, a red overall, a red water bottle. Of course, many of them have since been released. So the court came out to be weaponized, to use that word, for political opposition, that many of them, the purpose was to remand and put them in under some sort of lawful custody until, and of course, after elections, many of them were since released with guilty pleas and cautioned.
So, okay, now that we've gotten that out of the way, can we then talk about what you referred to as the primary challenge of, say, political competition in Uganda being essentially the lack of respect for the rule of law? Now, if you look at 2025, how are you going to confront this issue? Because I can see a situation where, like I said, you have to like repair the plane as you fly it. Your client will continue to participate in politics, but then you're dealing with an environment where you don't think the rule of law is being respected. What are the strategies here? And speaking as a human rights lawyer, what would you recommend to the legal fraternity that this is what we ought to do to adjust to the situation?
Of course, I'm such a firm believer in the rule of law that and the institutions it sets in place. That's the reason, one of the reasons why I always go to court, even when many times we don't receive judgments on time. You have a person tortured in 2021, you go to court, the law says you have judgment in 1 year and 4 years later. But then again, I always say, if you don't do that, then what? So, first of all, court gives us a chance to document these issues. And for me, I'm a firm believer in also testing these institutions. And that's one of the strategies that I always tell people, that we have to push back, because I don't believe that, because we are in a struggle in a state which has very little respect for the law, and in security agencies which have very little respect. So for me, the issue is to always have that pushback from like-minded people, like-minded lawyers, but then also from the general public. Because even the judiciary, despite the fact that the law sets it to be independent, it's also receiving the pressure from the, it's receiving a push. So it can only try to garner up whatever energies to be independent if we show that it has some supporting mechanisms. And of course, one of the biggest challenges, Angelo, outside politics, is the death of other supporting institutions. Because, for instance, a vibrant civil society would help the opposition in some of the things it's doing. A very independent press would help the opposition in some of the work it's doing. You find that now, almost all the work is left to the opposition, and they ask the opposition, which in itself is depleted, by the way. It's depleted by infiltration, it's depleted by incompetence, and so on and so forth. So you find that you are doing what countries which have found themselves where Uganda is, like Kenya at some point and Zimbabwe, have had all people firing at all fronts. We've had religious leaders asking government to account. Now, sadly, that is left to a very small group of people in Uganda. What I always encourage other people, and the key strategy, is that keep pushing. Keep pushing, because, one, you are helping to document. But then again, sometimes you harness, you get some fruits here and there. You get a progressive judgment. Recently, despite all the problems we have of backlog and all, we got a judgment from the High Court, it's not even 2 months old, where police officers were being ordered to pay monies, I think 75 million, each of them, not Attorney General, but each of the officers who brutalized people. So once in a while, when you keep pushing, you get one or two low-hanging fruits.
Finally, George, would you say, because my impression is then that the work you do, the nature of clients you have, all of that is a discourse on the state of the rule of law.
True.
Are public attitudes changing towards the rule of law? Would you say that there is much more support for the idea that all Ugandans should be treated equally before the law?
Yes, I think the public attitudes are right. The only thing lacking what I'm saying is the general apathy or the energy to do the extra step. If you go on social media, and let's use an example of that, the viral video of an old woman being dragged by police officers, you'll find so many people condemning it. However, if you took maybe a civic step and said, how many people joined me in a march against this, you'll find very few. So people watch these things on their news, their primetime news, they condemn it. People tweet about these things. But then the next step, even if you look at my profession, the lawyers, there are over 5,000 registered lawyers in Uganda, over 5,000 of them. We can't even get 100 handling human rights matters. You can't even get 50 out of 5,000. That is, so that shows you that, because I'm talking about lawyers, because they at least they know that this is wrong or this is illegal, that how comes you don't have a whole body of at least 50 lawyers coming out to handle issues, maybe pro bono or substantively. So there's a general awareness, but then we lack that extra mile.
Well, George, next time we have you on the show, hopefully we can discuss this issue of, you know, how do you deal with collective action problems in a country that is young, where information is available, where the tools such as social media are available. Why is it that attitude towards the rejection of violations of human rights by the larger portion of the public and not consolidating and causing changes that we all desire?
Sure.
Thank you for coming.